Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the January 7th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Arcola City Council. Committee squabbles over hiring process of city worker by Nolan Morse. The Arcola City Council found itself in a quandary Monday night over the hiring process for the public works maintenance position. The city posted a listing for the position and scheduled interviews without realizing that the mayor had already told a current part-time employee that he would be promoted to the position. City Administrator Bill Wagner said city ordinance states that all positions must be posted and go through the hiring process. Mayor Jesus Garza indicated a precedence for promoting current employees without going through that process. He said he's seen that happen 3 times since he's been mayor. Discussing the issue in a water and sewer committee meeting, the council members agreed there are 2 ways to proceed and both have bad optics. Do you tell the people who have scheduled interviews that the position isn't open, or do you tell the person who was promised the job that they now have to interview for it? The consensus of the committee was to uphold the promise made to the current employee, but still interview the top candidates for a list of potential hires, which is common practice for the city. About 20 people reportedly applied for the position. The final decision will go before the full city council at its next meeting. The city also advertised for public works director. Wagner said applications for the position are now closed. 3 people have been selected for interviews on January 14th. The public works director is responsible for the planning, directing, and supervising of the department. The job includes responding to emergency situations such as water main breaks and severe weather threats. The position also coordinates with contractors, engineers, regulatory agencies, etc. The position pays between $75,000 and $85,000 per year. During the regular council meeting, allocation of tourism funds were approved, with $1,400 going to the Arcola Chamber of Commerce, $600 to the city, $1,200 to the Arcola Community Organization, and $2,300 toward Country Spirit. The next article, from Home Oven to Main Street, New Bakery Puts Dessert First, by Nolan Morse. The journey of running Dessert First doesn't just start in the back of the bakery's kitchen in the early morning hours. It began more than 6 years ago, where Samantha Baird started baking out of her home. Thought up as nothing more than a little side project for extra money during pandemic times, the journey started off small. While working a full-time job, Samantha would bake in her spare time, then travel all over Illinois to vendors and pop-up locations selling her sweets anywhere she could. She was not alone, as her husband Jared Baird was there to support her from the beginning, standing by her side, especially when the times got rough. The Bairds would continue the system, baking for business and selling in advance, until eventually they baked themselves out of their home. Samantha's sweets had become too popular to where she couldn't keep up with the orders while baking at her house. At a crossroads of what to do, they gave themselves 2 choices, either stop the baking business entirely or put all their chips in, and all in they went. Seeing the historic building at 117 West Sales Street, Tuscola, in Jared's hometown, up for rent, they knew they couldn't let this opportunity go to waste. Acquiring the lease in April 2025, they had a long journey ahead of them, but they were determined to let nothing get in their way. The nights were sleepless from the start, but that doesn't slow down Tuscola's newest bakery in the slightest. Months-long renovations were underway, the Bairds doing most of it themselves with help from family. After 9 long months of crafting something they viewed as magical, they were ready to open it to the public. Opening day was December 6, 2025, and right off the bat, people fell in love. Compliments on the cookies, cinnamon rolls, brownies, and mostly the decor. Customers stated it feels like walking into a Disney movie. It was love at first sight for the customers walking in. But the process to keep the treats rolling is no easy task. Monday through Wednesday, Samantha's behind an oven, mixing dough and perfecting her craft starting at 5 a.m. Everything is homemade and from scratch, with papers of all the recipes taped to fridges and cabinets, proving a little method to the madness. When everything is finally all prepared, they open their doors at 9 a.m. on Thursday. Samantha gets to happily watch all her hard work pay off with satisfied customers. Manning the front counter, Jared greets every passerby with a friendly smile, setting the tone to a wonderful, welcoming environment. Their collective mission is to provide the best possible experience to everyone who walks through their doors, whether it's friendly hospitality, delicious bakery items, or most often a combination of both. Juggling all that while taking care of 2 young kids definitely added to the stress and chaos, but instead of letting it slow them down, they simply made them stronger as a team. Samantha and Jared run the business themselves, having no paid employees on staff. They stressed many times how grateful they have been from all the support and help they've received from family and friends. One of their favorite parts of running their business is adding to the variety and value of Tuscola's downtown. They happily serve the people, seeing many recognizable faces and providing their community with something quickly adored. One quote from the couple being, "We wanted to bake for the people of Tuscola and give them the best experience possible, and we hope to be the bright spot in someone's day." Samantha and Jared didn't know what's to come for their business. It may be one day expansion is in their future or if they stay in their hometown bakery. But despite all the unknowns, all the struggles they've faced, they can gladly smile at their business and tell the world to eat desserts first. And the last first page article, Kelsey Moore to compete in the state pageant. The 66th annual Miss Illinois County Fair Queen Pageant will be held Thursday, January 15th through Sunday, January 18th at the Crown Plaza in Springfield. The pageant will be held in conjunction with the 115th Illinois Association of Agricultural Fairs annual convention. Kelsey Moore, 2025 Miss Moultrie County, will compete for the title of 2026 Miss Illinois County Fair Queen, along with 75 other young ladies vying for the title this year. Her interview portion will be held on Friday, January 16th. Moore's preliminary will be held at 7 p.m. on Saturday, January 17th. Preliminaries consist of speech, swimsuit, and evening gown. The finals will take place on Sunday evening as the top 16 will be announced and non-finals will be recognized at that time. The top 16 finalists will start over with all four categories, along with answering three pop questions on stage, and a new queen will then be crowned. The reigning Miss Illinois County Fair Queen is Joanna Folker of Jacksonville. She represented Henry County at the annual pageant held January 2025. As the 65th Miss Illinois County Queen Fair Queen, Miss Folker was the annual hostess at the Illinois and Duquesne County Fairs. We'll move now to the obituaries. LaVon Lucille Bonnie Conlon, 90 of Arthur, passed away at 4:59 a.m. Thursday, January 1st, 2026 at St. John's Hospital in Springfield. Mass of Christian burial was held at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Arcola, Monday, January 5th, with Father Michael Trummer officiant. Burial followed in the Arthur Cemetery. Visitation was held Sunday, January 4th at the Schrader Funeral Home in Arthur. Netta LeMay Funk, 76, of Cerro Gordo, left this earth and went into her heavenly home December 27, 2025. Visitation was Friday, January 2nd at Brindlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Cerro Gordo. A funeral service followed at the funeral home. Burial was in the Cerro Gordo Cemetery. John Michael Bosch, age 91, of Newman, passed away peacefully at his home on December 28, 2025. Services were held Monday, January 5th at Joint's Funeral Home in Newman. Visitation preceded the funeral. Burial was at the Newman Cemetery. The next article, temporary visitor guidelines and masking recommendations reduce the spread of illness. Carle Health Facilities update prevention protocols due to increasing respiratory illness activity. As all Carle Health Services areas throughout central and southeastern Illinois face increasing rates of respiratory illness, the health system is taking temporary precautions in line with the comprehensive viral respiratory prevention and control recommendations from the Illinois Department of Public Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The updated guidelines include: patient rooms are limited to two visitors at a time and visitors must be 18 years or older. Anyone experiencing respiratory symptoms are strongly encouraged to wear a mask while on our facilities. This temporary shift will support a safer care environment at Carle Hospital facilities as the most impactful portion of the respiratory illness season continues to affect the community. Carle Health team members will also be taking steps and extra precautions to limit spread. Carle Health continuously monitors the rate of RSV, flu, COVID-19, and other infections in the areas we serve and have seen a steady incline over the past weeks. Robert Healy, MD, Carle Health Quality Patient Safety and Patient Experience Chief Executive Medical Director, said, based on this data and the recommendations of IDPH and CDC, taking additional temporary precautions in our care facilities is necessary to reduce the spread of illness. Lowering the amount of symptomatic interactions between community members with temporary visitor restrictions has helped patients recover quicker and reduce the amount of people who can contract infections. Studies continue to show the positive impact masks and reducing exposure can offer to lessen the transmission of viral illnesses. Carle Health experts will continue to evaluate respiratory illness rates and provide an update when levels reach a point where the temporary restrictions can be lifted. Taking these measures will help all community members stay well, especially those at most risk, like the young, elderly, and immunocompromised. The health system continues to encourage all community members to stay mindful throughout the season to maintain good hand hygiene, wear a mask when symptomatic, stay home when feeling ill, and stay up to date on eligible vaccines to create a healthier community. For more information about visitor guidelines at Carle Health Facilities, visit carle.org. The next article, Arcola Alumni Association honors John Curry as one of its oldest graduates, by Sue Stout. As Arcola Alumni Association continues recognition of Arcola High School graduates who have reached the age of 90 and beyond, we honor John Curry, who graduated with the AHS class of 1952. John acknowledges he may not have learned a lot at Arcola High School, but lightheartedly relates that he certainly had a good time. Accordingly, he considers pretty much everybody to have been his friend while in high school. John Wesley Curry, the first of six children of Horace and Joyce Smith Curry, was born May 24, 1932 in Peoria. John and his parents relocated to his grandparents' home south of Mattoon and then Charleston when his father was employed by Illinois Consolidated Telephone Company. John explains he was sick and puny a lot as a young child. He developed a serious ear infection at the age of two or three, requiring surgery that left him with a hearing loss and the effects of a stroke. As a young boy growing up in Coles County in the 1930s, John's memories of the Great Depression include the WPA government work crews, the extreme drought, and the continued struggle of the farmers. He also recalls that bums claiming to be World War I veterans came to the Curry home to ask for meals. Four of John's five siblings, Roger, Dan, Barbara, and Robert, were also Depression-era babies. His sister Deborah was born in November after John graduated from high school in 1952. It was certainly Arcola's good fortune when the telephone company transferred John's father to Arcola in the early 1940s. John and his family moved to Arcola, and his father later opened a hardware store in 1945 that would serve the Arcola community well for decades. John and his siblings attended Eastside Grade School through eighth grade. He was nine when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and remembers many local young men who soon joined the military service, including those who left high school before their graduation. John notes some soldiers were able to complete their education at Arcola High School when they returned home following the war. He also has memories of military planes flying over Arcola. John entered Arcola High School in the fall of 1948. He played football all 4 years and lettered his junior year playing center guard and defensive end. He was pleased when Arcola rallied in the fourth quarter to hand Tuscola their first loss of the season on November 10, 1950, allowing Arcola to share the OCA championship with Monticello and Tuscola. The November 16, 1950 Arcola Record Herald explained Arcola's 12-9 victory was especially gratifying as Tuscola was heavily favored and looking for their 11th straight victory over Arcola. John lettered again his senior year as left tackle. Arcola defeated Tuscola 20-6 on Monday afternoon, November 12, 1951, giving Arcola a repeated share of the OCA championship. Both Monticello and Arcola were undefeated in conference play for the season. During his time at Arcola High School, John was also a four-year member of the track team, competing in hurdles and other running events. Additionally, he participated in Future Farmers of America and was the boys' sports editor for the Arco Light. The 12-13-51 senior class play, The Campbells Are Coming, was a sellout in the high school auditorium. The 12-20-1951 Arcola Record Herald reported that John Curry kept the house in laughter in his role of Bildad Tap, the hillbilly father. In the 1952 Torch Yearbook, senior John Curry was remembered for wrecking cars. He explains his poor old car was a 1940 Studebaker named the Blue Streak Special. It had been a family car, but by John's high school year, the car had fallen on hard times and occasionally had one door. John remembers that he and a young lady friend were coming home from the movie in Tuscola when they slid on loose gravel in the Filson Road. The Blue Streak Special overturned. John fell from the car when his door popped open and he suffered a dislocated hip. In his own defense, he explains he could not have been speeding because the car would not go over 50 miles per hour. John worked several jobs throughout his high school years, including his work in his dad's hardware store and also for Sam Blackwell, a local farmer. He and his friends found time for fun while in high school, too, gathering at Lester's Sweet Shop in downtown Arcola, where they danced to jukebox music and enjoyed hamburgers, chocolate milkshakes, and Cokes. When asked about his other good memories of AHS, John tells about the fun times with his pet pig. He was visiting friend Hampton Parker on the farm when Hampton's father offered John one of Parker's runt pigs if he could catch it. John accepted the challenge, caught the pig, put it in a sack, and took it home. Nelson Roberts, ag teacher and FFA advisor, convinced John to bring the pig to school where it was confined in a pen. The Curry pig was eventually named Stanley Hutchinson after the pig character in a story from English class. Stanley was a hit as he joined the senior class play cast of The Campbells Are Coming on stage at the high school auditorium. Stanley continued to do well during John's senior year until some of the kids loaded him into John's car. By that time, the runt pig weighed 200 pounds and was not housebroken. The prize Stanley Hutchinson AHS attendee and senior class play character was soon sold for $20. John relates history was his favorite class during his high school years, taught by Miss Modesta Scott. He also credits Mr. John Powers, AHS principal and shop teacher, Mr. Nelson Roberts, his ag teacher, and Andy Sullivan, his football coach, when asked about memorable favorite teachers. The S-529-52 Arcola Record Herald reported 28 seniors graduated the Arcola High School senior class of 1952 in the high school auditorium on Tuesday evening, May 27th. Many of the graduates remained in or returned to the Arcola area, including Curtis Atterbury, Archie Daigh, Joyce Gear, Miller Hancock, Pauline Grant Case, Jesse Gray Birch, Sabine Hayes Strader, Oscar Jacob, Bill Kaufenfleisch, Donnie Miller, Bill Sargent, Dwayne Strader, and Dave Vandeveer. Following his 1952 high school graduation, John's hearing loss prevented him from military service in Korea, but he was hired by Central Illinois Public Service Company to work on the tree crew at Paxton in July of that same year. Late in 1954, one of his co-workers recommended that John get to know the little girl with the long red hair who was working in the Paxton CIPS office. John remembers he asked the petite redhead named Laura Fields for a November 11th movie date and then willingly cut his first day of pheasant shooting short in order to be presentable for his special date. He soon learned Laura was a wonderful person and they were married in Paxton on August 14, 1955. John continued his training as a lineman apprentice at the Paxton Utility Company in hope of moving on from the tree crew for more technical work as a lineman. He was hired as a CIPS lineman in Olney in 1956, and the young couple relocated to the community where they soon developed a strong commitment to their church and community service. Their daughter Amy was born in 1964 and attended Olney schools, where she excelled as a distance runner before enrolling at the University of Evansville to study marketing. The Curry family attended the Olney First United Methodist Church, where John served on the board and also volunteered his carpentry skills at the church. In the early years at Olney, he joined the Junior Chamber of Commerce and became acquainted with other young people in the community. He soon became a member of the Elks Lodge and is now one of their oldest members. John was involved with the Kiwanis for many years, served with the Shriners, and also served as a board member of the Salvation Army. Laura retired from CIPS after 30 years of service. And John then retired in 1994 after 42 years with the same company. Retirement provided more time for John and Laura to work around the house, entertain, and travel, including trips to Texas, California, Jamaica, Chicago, and New York City. John enjoyed collecting and refinishing antiques and restoring older homes. His woodworking skills also contributed to the creation and sale of birdhouses and charcuterie boards. He and Laura shared 59 years together before her passing on September 28, 2014. John now fills his free time listening to history books and Bible on Alexa. He enjoys visits with family and friends, including some linemen he worked with at CIPS. His siblings appreciate his fun-loving and congenial personality and say John is as popular as high school football boy with a parade of visitors coming and going to his home. John is especially pleased when his daughter, Amy Sherman, and her husband, Peter, visit from Newport, Rhode Island. He adds he's proud of their marketing careers have taken them all over the world. Curry's mind is still sharp, and he does not consider himself old at age 93, but he does acknowledge that his body does not work as it once did. John is grateful for those who help him. A retired Olney teacher provides assistance in his home by preparing meals and driving him to his appointments. John said she's a very nice lady until the exercises sessions begin, and then her sergeant stripes take over during his 45-minute workout. John Curry walked across the auditorium stage to receive his family's first Arcola High School diploma more than 73 years ago. All five of his siblings are also AHS graduates: Roger, class of 1954, Dan, 1956, Barbara Browning, 1956, Bob, 1957, and Debbie McGrew, 1970. Arcola Alumni Association is pleased to highlight the life of 1952 graduate John Curry and also welcomes recognition of other graduates who have reached the age of 90 and beyond. If any readers are AHS graduates 90 or older, or if you know one of Arcola's oldest graduates, please contact Sue Stoud at 217-840-6605 or any Arcola Alumni Association board member. The next article, Shields Going for Third Guinness World of Records by Mike Monahan. He is at it again. Chris Shields, a 1978 Arcola graduate, is going for his third Guinness World Record. My motivation is to give everyone a chance to have a certificate doing the easiest thing I can think of, said Shields. The inspiration was when I was driving home one day and saw a bunch of kids playing pitch and catch and decided to explore the category. This time, Shields is going to try and set the record for the largest game of pitch and catch. More friends of mine were asking, what is something they can do perhaps with their children to earn a Guinness Book of World Records? I came across this category this spring last year. The record, when Shields found it, was broken and is now 2,358 people or 1,179 pairs. The rules and regulations of this category are for ages 7 and older, softballs or baseballs only must be used with one partner bringing one or the other. No hard throws are allowed, and baseball softball gloves are recommended, but not required. The pairs must be at least 10 feet apart and throw to each other for 5 minutes. According to Shields, there will be water stations, food trucks, entertainment, and celebrities, as well as plenty of volunteers to stage and direct you where to go. The event is free, and you can go to pitchandcatch.org to register. You will need to provide basic information and can upload photos and videos. Children under 16 must have a parent or guardian register for them. Everyone participating must agree to the safety guidelines and liability waiver. The website also has merchandise, t-shirt offers available to order. The event is to take place May 9th at the corner of Lincoln and Florida in Champaign on University campus. When the participants arrive, you'll go based on where you signed up. A100 will be Section A, and 101 to 200 in Section B, etc. The event runs until 6 p.m. The venue will hold 12,000 people, but I'm cutting it off at 10,000 if it gets out of hand, said Shields. The meat of the category is the adjudicator or judge who wants to see X thousand people doing the same thing. In 2004, Shields thought they set a world record as being part of the longest softball game. The game started June 5th at 7 a.m. and ended 1:35 p.m. on June 7th. The marathon game was played for 30 hours and 28 minutes and was 176 innings. My daughters Hannah and Olivia got me into the Guinness Book of World Records book, and I was looking through it and I saw the longest softball game was 30 hours and 5 minutes, said Shield in a Journal Gazette Times Courier story in 2004. I'm thinking that's attainable. The game between sports establishing the old style ended in 425-425 tie. Both teams, 17 players each, had large leads, leading by as much as 30 runs at one time. The game was played at the now defunct TK Wendell's, and proceeds went to cystic fibrosis and raised over $2,500. However, a group in Ireland had 55 hours 2 weeks before the Shields attempt, and the Ireland group did not send it in right away. The Guinness Book of World Records awarded the record to the Ireland group. The second record and first official record occurred July 6, 2013, when Shields entered the Guinness Book of World Records for catching a softball from 250 feet in the air. It's a record that still stands. The record took place on the farm of Larry Yoder, and Ernie Borntrager videoed the event. The latest record Shields was a part of was the last event at Nancy Stiff Gymnasium before COVID-19 hit. Shields and nine others set the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest wiffle ball game. They played from 7 a.m. on Saturday, March 7th until 11 a.m. Sunday, March 8th, a total of 426 innings. Shields said he subsequently submitted his longest wiffle ball game ever played to Guinness World Records through the standard application process and then waited for evidence review, which can take up to 12 weeks to process. In the meantime, Shield said a group of 10 youths played a 30-hour, one-minute game on June 20 to 21, 2020 in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Shields and the group had the record for about 4 months. The record before Shields' group broke it was 26 hours, 22 minutes, and 10 seconds held by two teams in Duluth, Minnesota. There was no base running in the game, as where you hit is determined whether it was a single, double, triple, or home run. A home run was worth 4 points, a triple three, a double two, and a single one. A player could strike out as there was a gong, like the original one, the 1970s game show entitled The Gong Show, behind home plate, and if the wiffle ball hit it and made the gong sound, it was a strike. Two witnesses were present at all times, keeping track of breaks also. The entire game was taped on a video stick. Shields married to Julie Shields and has three daughters, Hannah, Olivia, and Emma, and is the son of Joyce and late Ted Shields. Chris Shields is retired union electrician, 42 years, and is now a systems director at the Newman Foundation at the University of Illinois campus. The next article, Lots of Things Not to Talk About This Week, by the Ramblin' Man David Porter. I think I'll take this week off. This time of year is pretty slow in some regards and pretty busy in other ways. Because of the holidays, and in particular Postal Service days off, my schedule was pretty messed up. In order to get the papers done and in the mail, I ended up working both Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I'm not complaining. We don't have little kids at home, but we just pick a different day to open our presents. When you're the only one getting a lump of coal and new pajamas, what difference does it make? I'm fibbing. I didn't get any new pajamas. I used to when I was a kid. It was always exciting when you're 8 years old to unwrap pajamas, socks, and underwear on Christmas morning, said no kid ever. I can't complain. I got plenty of toys, too, except 1 year when I was 10. There was nothing but clothes under the tree for me, and I was not happy with Santa that year. The next year, I was feeling more grown up and was looking forward to new clothes. That year, it was nothing but little kid toys. I think that's when I realized that low expectations pay better dividends. This year, I got an indoor-outdoor thermometer, which I had asked for. I think my wife is regretting the purchase because now 10 times a day, I walk into the room and announce the temperature. But I don't want to talk about my Christmas. Seems trite. I hope you had a good one. I don't want to talk about the news either. You get the news so you know what's in it. You don't need my opinion. I don't want to talk about the weather. You get the weather too, although I can tell you how cold it is in my patio. Or can I? When I put batteries in the outdoor unit, I was inside next to the indoor unit and the two readings were more than 2 degrees apart. I read the manual and it said it was normal. I blame the size difference in the vents that lead to the sensors. I don't believe it. The actual temperature should be the same regardless of the vent size. It's like the old saying, a man with a watch always knows what time it is. A man with two watches is never sure. But I don't want to talk about that, and it's boring. Yet probably the most exciting event in my life this week. There are a lot of things I don't want to talk about, mostly because I don't want to talk. To quote James McMurtry's song, all I want now is a comfortable chair. Lucky for me, I have one of those. I don't want to talk about it, though, and I'm pretty sure you don't want to read about it. So I think I'll just take this week off and not write about anything. My dad says if I do that every week, see if I get him any new pajamas next year. The next article, Finding Joy Daily, Hook, Line, and Sinker by Tony Hooker. Jeremiah was a bullfrog. He was a good friend of mine. I never understood a single word he said, but I helped him drink his wine, and he always had some mighty fine wine. Joy to the World by Three Dog Night. As often happens, Father Trummer's homily this week struck a note with me. The main theme was recognition of joy as being an integral part of life, both within the church and out. It just so happens I recently learned a bit about St. Therese of Lisieux, and I resolved to try to incorporate her little way into my everyday activities in 2026. Without going too far down a theological rabbit hole, in her autobiography, Story of a Soul, St. Therese revealed that she always wanted to be a saint, but felt her life was too ordinary when compared to the exploits of those who had come before her, so she resolved to find joy, holiness, and virtue in everyday tasks and situations that she faced. As one who is given to finding great pleasure in the simple things, this philosophy has really resonated with me as of late. A good meal, a good conversation, certain song lyric, and so many other things bring joy to my heart, so it was easier for me to find a connection. Of course, I couldn't begin to compare to her. When diagnosed with terminal tuberculosis at the age of 24, she said to have cried tears of joy at the thought that her passing would hasten her time to see the face of God. Mrs. HLS will attest, I'm a big wimp when it comes to any sort of ailment. A common cold is enough to send me to bed for days, so I'm pretty sure I wouldn't do good when factoring something so serious. In another famous example of a saint continuing to express joy in the face of terrible situation, St. Paul exhorted the Philippians to rejoice in the Lord. Always, I say it again, rejoice, while being imprisoned in Rome. It is widely believed the Emperor Nero had him beheaded soon after, yet even knowing his eventual fate, he continued to express irrepressible joy and trust in God. In World War II, St. Maximilian Kolbe was a Polish Franciscan friar who was executed in the Auschwitz concentration camp after he famously volunteered to take the place of another prisoner who had been marked for death. After a prisoner escaped, the deputy camp commander selected 10 prisoners to be executed via starvation, and St. Maximilian volunteered to take the place of one of the chosen 10. Once in the starvation cell, Kolbe led the other inmates in prayer and singing of hymns. After 2 weeks without food or water, Kolbe and 3 other prisoners remained alive, frustrating the SS so much they chose to execute them by injection of carbolic acid. It is said that St. Maximilian held out his left arm in defiance when his turn came. 3 saints, 300 examples of people being able to find joy in face of horrific circumstances. I suppose if they, along with 1 amphibian enophile, can be joyful, it shouldn't be too hard for the rest of us to do the same thing, right? I resolve to keep on trying. Joy to the world, indeed. And we have time for some briefs. Arcola Housing Forum. The city of Arcola is holding a public forum at 6 p.m. Monday, January 12th to discuss housing needs. Hannah Myers, Community Development Coordinator for the city, said the forum will provide an opportunity to share feedback and ideas about current housing conditions and future housing development and community growth. The forum is in partnership with the Illinois Housing Development Authority. Arcola Senior Potluck. Arcola seniors invited to attend a potluck at the Arcola Center on January 16th. Lunch will begin at 11:30 a.m. Seniors may bring a dish to share. Arthur Events. January 16th through 17th, Custom Home and Interior Showcase at the iHotel in Champaign. January 19th, Senior Luncheon at the Community Building. January 30th, Annual Pickers Advertising Auction, Tri-County Auction Facility. January 30th, Blacksmith Auction, Tri-County Auction Facility. February 3rd, annual winter toy auction at Tri-County Auction Facility, and February 7th, Arthur EMT Chili Supper at the Firehouse. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye, and see you again next week.